Good evening. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich, and welcome to a Town Square special, our annual look at some of the selections at the Maui Film Festival, spotlighting public policy and social issues. The festival runs through this weekend at several Maui locations. Tonight, we'll talk with four of the filmmakers about subjects ranging from the experience of a transgender kumu in Hawaii to how we create worldwide capacity for potable water, if we can save the planet and our species, including people who depend on drugs in the public domain to mitigate pain. As the conversations had to be recorded to bring them to you tonight, the phone lines will have to wait until next week. Tennis legend Arthur Ashe once said, "Start where you are, use what you have, do what you can." Those words could sum up the themes of the four films we'll consider tonight. We'll start with this one about a transgender woman, cultural practitioner, and teacher trying to find the balance between Pacific Island and Western values. Dean Hamer co-directed Kumuhina, and I asked him how he approached a story that had the potential to make some people very uncomfortable.
The thread that holds everything together and that it makes it such a non-threatening and, in fact, appealing story is the thread of Hawaiian culture, because that's something that runs through Hina's life, at what's made her confident and comfortable as a transgender woman. And it's a very strong element in the school, so that you understand that this isn't about the way that Westerners look at things as a person's sexuality or gender. This is about a Hawaiian tradition. And the Hawaiian tradition has always been that every person has both male and female aspects, and it's a matter of balancing them. And that people that have both male and female aren't crippled by that. They're actually blessed. They have a special talent. We see that in Hina. We see that in this wonderful young girl, Ho'onani, who does become leader of the boys' hula troupe. And it's really the rooting in Hawaiian culture that makes it so strong.
She seems at times to move fluidly between both the male and female aspects of herself. And also we see that replicated in Ho's way of approaching her family life. Her mother talks a little bit about, well, you know, underneath all that, you're still a girl.
Yes, really what Hina is teaching is a sort of Pacific Islander way of life and a Pacific Islander philosophy. Of course, living in Hawaii, we also have a lot of other influences, Western influences, church influences, and it's really Hina's way of weaving those all together that I think gives strength to the story, and it gives strength to Ho'onani to be the person that she is.
As we were going through many of the debates about first civil unions and then far more recently about same-sex marriage, there were people who were saying, well, same-sex marriage is not Hawaiian, which seems to be very much not the case. How do you disentangle all of those Western influences that have so integrated themselves into Hawaiian culture and look at some more of it with a sense of purity as you've tried to make this film?
Well, we've really left it up to Hina to do that. And it was true that during the marriage debates, we were hearing people say, oh, this is a Western invention. And really, it's marriage that's the Western idea, not the sex part of it. So Hina was very strong in explaining to people that Hawaiians have a long history of a variety of different arrangements, including aikane and mahu and multiple arrangements, and that really is the Hawaiian tradition. We as filmmakers, coming from the continental USA originally ourselves, didn't want to be the ones to try to interpret it. We avoided having any academics come into the picture, and we really just let Hina and her colleagues speak for themselves.
As we now know, the story ended at a certain point, and she says at the very end of it that unconditional acceptance and respect is really what aloha is all about. And she also says that there's some uncertainty surrounding her relationship with her husband. Looking at your Facebook page for the show, clearly everybody is off together, or at least was very recently, in New Zealand. Are things going well for her?
Things seem to be going very well for Hina. And in fact, I think the making of the movie and the wonderful reception the movie has had amongst Pacific Islanders and really everybody in Hawaii has encouraged her and made her realize even more that her voice is one that deserves to be heard and needs to be heard. which is why that she recently decided actually to run for political office for the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, someplace where her voice can be heard at a, you know, even at a higher level and really influence policy.
So it seemed that as much as her story was shaping or perhaps is continuing to shape other people's lives, her life also was shaped by the film.
Yes, I think so, to a certain degree, and I think that's really wonderful in a very positive way. And the reception of the film of Pacific Islanders, not just in Hawaii, but now here in New Zealand, where the Maori culture is, you know, close cousins to Hawaiian culture, has really been fantastic. People are really, Pacific Islanders are happy to see their lives depicted on screen, because that doesn't very often happen outside of movies about hula and music. To see people's ordinary lives on screen is something fairly unusual, and a lot of Pacific Islander folks are quite happy about that.
But although I know you've talked about them as Pacific Islander folks, there really are many different layers and complexities to what that means, depending upon which Pacific Island culture one comes from. And seeing some of that smack up against itself was also, you know, very refreshing for some people, and other people were made uncomfortable. How has that been playing out as you've watched other people from different Pacific Island cultures watch the film?
It's really been very strongly positive. And when we were making the film, we were a little bit worried that people would say, oh, this is against a religious belief, or this isn't exactly the way our culture treats things. But at least so far, there's been a very strong positive response. A lot of people coming out and saying, you know, this is really what our culture is about, and we're happy to see it finally on film. I think people tend to pussyfoot around a little bit, worrying about what other people might think, but at least the Hawaiian folks that we've met and the Maori folks that we've met have been really quite quite happy to see these realities of their life on screen. What will happen when we go to Fiji or to Tonga or to other places, I don't know. That's all to be seen.
But it will be really interesting to note those differences. But from what you've just said about how the reception of the film is causing people to be pleased to see some of this, because it is real life and in many ways unscripted, how, though, do you look at this and say, okay, life happens and you got to let it happen and document it in such a way that we also feel that there is that sense of the unknown about it? I mean, it seems so tough to do, even when you're talking about cinema verite and knowing that you're capturing what you're capturing, then being able to weave it into a story later on. It just seems like in so many ways we're uncomfortable with it not having a proper ending, some would say.
Well, that is always the trick of verite. And as some people say, the most boring movie in the world is real life. It just keeps on going on and on. So we depend a lot on a wonderful editor that we have, Nels Bankmeter, to try to shape the story. We were really lucky in that although there are aspects of the story that are very complex and have layers and go up and down and don't exactly resolve, that the story that occurred in the school over the year that we were filming had very much of a movie-like feel, a story feel, with a beginning and a middle and a wonderful ending. And quite a few people here in New Zealand who've seen the film say, oh, this is just like The Whale Rider, another story about a young girl who wants to do everything that everyone else does and that the boys do. And I don't want to totally give away the ending of the film, but it does have a real conclusion, at least for that year.
At least for that year. That year is now over. Are you still in touch with Ho'onani?
Oh, absolutely. And one of the real highlights of the premiere of the film in Oahu at the Hawaii International Film Festival was that Ho'onani and her entire family, and actually a lot of her classmates, were at the screening. And afterwards, Ho'onani came up on stage along with all the kids from this school. And we gave her the mic, and she stood up there and said, well, you might be wondering what it feels like. For me, it's just a natural thing, and I know some people are all on one side or all on the other side. It's okay. I accept them, even though they're not as blessed as I am, and then thanked her mother for her leadership. So Yeah, she's very much a part of the movie, and she's getting on with her life. And I think we're going to hear more from Hoanani as time goes along.
There's a lovely scene where she's sitting on a stairway in the arms of Hina and really trying to make sense of where she is at that moment and leading this troop of boys and also being in the middle and not necessarily having to make a decision, even though other people may want her to make the decision. And Hina tells her, well, you know, at some point in time, you're not going to have to do what they want you to do. You're going to be able to make your own decisions. But for the moment, you're still a kid. That's a pretty tough line for people to hear at some point, particularly when they are kids.
Well, it is. And what's amazing about that scene is that Hina's being a wonderful mentor. She's being very protective of her. She's being very realistic at the same time. She's doing everything that a teacher should do. And Ho'onani's response is truly amazing because she says, well, I understand Hina feels that way, that you should do what other people tell you to do because, you know, she's old. But I'm young, and I believe in speaking the truth all the time. So it's almost like the student has become the teacher. And I think it's just the real, you know, strength of character of that young girl that makes her that way. And she's still exactly like that, which is quite wonderful.
Dean, is there anything about this film that you wished that someone would have asked you about and didn't?
I think the thing that people are most interested in is the relationship part, because Hina, like all persons, desires to have love in a committed relationship. But we very seldom see that playing out for people who are in the middle or mahu or transgender. So I just hope people will see this relationship with all of its ups and downs and realize that it's just like any other relationship, two human beings coming together. There are always going to be a lot of ups and downs.
And it's tough, no matter who you are, if you're trying to share your life with someone.
That's exactly the case. And, yeah, that it really is a universal love story and how difficult that can be at times, and as well as how important it is for everybody.
That was Dean Hamer, co-director of Kumuhina. If you missed tonight's screening at the Maui Film Festival, the movie's also coming to the Doris Duke Theater on June 5th, and Hina will be a featured speaker at the TEDx Maui in late September. Next, a film that looks at a clash of public policy. Neurons to Nirvana takes on the ban of psychedelic drugs that could mitigate pain in a time when prescription drug abuse kills 100 people daily, according to the National Institute of Drug Abuse. The film asks why once legal drugs, and ones that exist in nature, aren't able to be used now for medicinal and transformative purposes. Here's executive producer Saul Tryon.
There's probably several reasons stemming from the government and the pharmaceutical industry. Obviously, that created a big stigma, and throughout the 60s and 70s, that was even created an even larger stigma. I would definitely say that's a big, big piece of it. And, you know, the purpose of the film is really to try to just engage that conversation and to see if we can try to reschedule these substances down from a Schedule 1 substance to a, say, Schedule 3, which allows for more research and government funding for that research and better access for people for medicinal purposes.
Well, as you know, Hawaii has been engaged in some of that quite actively over many years, looking at whether marijuana should be available for medical use. And we say it is, but we still have a problem with creating the whole dispensary part of it. And also in very recent years, looking at whether certain amounts should be available for recreational use and not come with gigantic penalties attached. We've seen what happened in Colorado, etc. Has that made it a better climate for you to release a film like this now?
Yeah, definitely. It's really in the zeitgeist right now, and everybody's starting to realize these incredible medicinal purposes, especially of marijuana, but also of MDMA and psilocybin and ayahuasca and LSD even. And it's a really great time to be able to engage that conversation and be able to express these feelings and thoughts and science and find the right ways that we can try to help cure people or at least alleviate some of their mental or physical pain.
All of these substances that you just named are being looked at through the lens of human and spiritual growth and also pain mitigation. And many of them are available or have been available for years, some in nature, some that were refined, but had the kibosh put on all of them in very recent years because of all the reasons that you just named a moment ago. Is there a way of being able to engage in some of the conversation, perhaps as an entry level to looking at all of those substances? Is marijuana really sort of the gateway conversation to why these other things that were once available are no longer available and should be rescheduled?
Yeah, I think so. Marijuana is the one that is obviously most acceptable to the mainstream audience, and people understand that it helps alleviate pain, and that is a big deal for people suffering from things like cancer and stuff, but it's also been proven to be highly effective in treating depression and PTSD and things like that. And even more so, recent findings are absolutely incredible for cancer treatment and actually helping to reduce the size of tumors and all of this sort of stuff coming to light and really being allowed to be presented to society just opens the door for research and at least the acceptance of the discussion amongst people of all of the other substances.
One of the researchers or docs in the film makes the point that when others went looking for some of the old research and some of the current research, that also was shut down pretty quickly, as if someone were giving them the very clear message, no, you're not to go down that path. How do you open those doors some more, or is exactly what this film is trying to do, that opening door?
Yeah, it's through research, and unfortunately, it's been through people that are suffering and in need of help that they haven't been able to get through mainstream medicinal purposes and practices. That's kind of where it starts, and then creating a conversation about that and actually having people that care and are compassionate about people that are suffering from different things and finding alternative ways to treat them. That's really where the conversation begins. And, of course, there are a lot of people that have incredible stigmas against all of these substances. And the second you talk about them in a medicinal purpose, everybody just thinks, oh, well, you just really want to get high. But it's incredible that the roadblocks that have been put up throughout, especially the past 40 years, and how difficult it has been to break down all of those barriers. But it's really, it's an exciting time. There's institutions that have been trying for a long time to be able to do these researches, and the way that they operate is all through grants and donations of people that care and want to help figure this out. And it's almost none of them are through any sort of government backing or funding, which that is definitely a travesty and something that we're all working hard to try to change. Actually, the first government funding of marijuana research has just been cleared in Colorado. I'm not sure exactly how that's going to play out, but it seems like the doors are opening.
As that research may be going forward, there are a lot of people who say, well, okay, medicinal use is one thing, recreational use may be something else. Then again, we have drug use by kids, which the Just Say No campaign in the war on drugs really hasn't helped to stem. Kids who say, hey, you can go to any club and get pretty much whatever you want, including ecstasy, and it's no big deal to be able to get it. Somehow a lot of those dollars have been shifted into trying to prevent all of that. Your point seems to be, why not put that into real serious science research?
Absolutely. And when you see these substances are made to be illegal and made to be supposedly difficult to get, but it ends up being not that difficult to find and get, and then it becomes sort of a thing where it's kind of cool to do the illegal thing or to the kids to be able to do something that's out there and different, whereas if they're kind of treated as something that is more just understood in society and not just straight up bad, then the stigma on both sides, on people and how they can be treated, and then also on, say, kids or teenagers that are looking to do something different, isn't as great, and there's a stronger sense of understanding there. And you can look at some of the other countries around the world that are starting to implement these things, like in Portugal, and they've legalized some really more addictive drugs to help and really treat them as people that are addicted to them as an illness, as opposed to it being a criminal offense. And that is really a huge step, I think. And you can see the levels of addiction in Portugal kind of going down. And it's just a matter of an understanding of what everything is that we're doing, we're treating, and the potentials that we have with the substances that we have available to us.
Do you find it ironic at all that as we are talking about these substances that you showcase in the film, we're also seeing a time where addiction to prescription drugs has been skyrocketing, and real efforts to try to get medicines that are intended for one person out of people's medicine cabinets and disposed of appropriately and not being able to have them readily available to other people unless they use them for recreational purposes. Is this another part of the irony of the discussion that you have in the film?
Absolutely. I mean, it's terrifying. The number of people that are overdosing on prescription drugs is really quite alarming. And more people die from overdoses on prescription drugs than die from car accidents. It's pretty alarming and terrifying, and it's a real problem. Yet it's kind of brushed under the rug from government and pharmaceutical agencies because of the amount of money that they make.
As you are trying to open the conversation, clearly there's a public policy underpinning to all of this, looking at truly how we start to regard these substances both for medicinal and possibly for recreational use in a safe way that's backed by science. Is it tougher now to be able to use a scientific argument when science has sort of become a little bit, in some people's minds, dicey or not worthwhile in the way, for example, it might have been 50 years ago?
I guess it depends on your perspective. Science, if you're looking at it in the sense of you need to be cured and there's science proving there's some of these substances might actually help you in a way that no doctor or other pharmaceutical drug can help you, then you're going to take that science very seriously and hopefully that helps you, you know? And at the same time, there's always going to be people that can argue two sides of any scientific argument. And that's just the way it is. And I think it all comes down to perspective and what you're looking at and what you need it to tell you, in a sense, as well. There's irrefutable evidence that these substances can help you. Will they always help every single individual that takes them? Probably not. Do we say that you should do them without supervision, without the guidance of a professional who's going to help you understand what the best purpose and the best use of them are? For sure not.
But that part seems to be the key, Saul, about having that real professional there, someone who is a doctor, a psychiatrist, someone who is well-schooled in what these things can and can't do, and having this be within the context of a professional setting as opposed to a free-for-all. And that seems to be where a lot of the differences are in the conversation, too. Given the fact that we also have much more brain research now than we've ever had before, seeing the little snippet of this is your brain on drugs seems to be almost a tongue-in-cheek, or maybe not so much of a tongue-in-cheek poke, at the fact that we know more about how brains really do work on and off drugs.
Yeah, absolutely. And the discovery of the fact that we have receptors in our system that are natural, built up to receive cannabidiol and things like this that are elements of cannabis, and that it helps us reduce tumors and all of these things. The science and the knowledge that we have on brain and our whole bodies are much greater. That why should we continue to have the same stance on these substances that we had before we had the knowledge that they could help us? It doesn't make any sense.
That also means, in some ways, you're changing what the DEA would like us to believe. That's a tough thing to do when you're talking about a government agency that big.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, nothing's going to happen overnight. Nothing's going to change in a day. It's really a matter of getting people to at least engage in the conversation, at least be open to the fact that these substances might actually have benefits. And then maybe we can help get them changed from a Schedule 1 to a Schedule 3 drug so that they can actually be used in research and the government actually support the research. And who knows what other positive elements we might learn from that. And that's really the point for us right now, is just say, hey, it's not all bad. Yes, drugs can be bad, and if used in the wrong way, in the wrong circumstances, they can be damaging, just like pharmaceutical drugs, just like all of that sort of stuff. But these substances that are natural, that have very little to no side effects at all, should be researched.
Is that part of the problem, that these things are in the public domain and they're not attached to any profit-making center like Big Pharma?
Definitely. I mean, if people could make a lot of money off it, and obviously people are making a lot of money off of these illegal substances in various ways, but if in a legal way it could be profitable much more so, then for sure I would think that there would be all sorts of people out there trying to lobby for different legalization of it so that their companies could use it and they could patent it and run with it and make millions. But since it's not, they want to have control over all the other drugs that they tell you that do the same things, but they have patents on, so they're much more safe and whatnot for you to take, when in fact that's not always the case.
Is the fallback position for a lot of folks, well, you know, if these things were available, you could just tax it, you'd have a revenue stream. Is that enough of an argument?
I don't think that's necessarily the full argument. That might work for some people that are looking at it strictly from a financial perspective. The main thing is that these can help people, and that's really what it comes down to, is do we want to try to help people feel better and cure illnesses that couldn't be cured in other ways? Then that's really what it comes down to, what's truly important. But for people that are look at it strictly from a financial thing, if that's what they need in order to convince them to allow these sorts of things to be researched and put out there, then by all means, that's a great thing.
All right, we're going to leave it there. And as you say, the bottom line for you in this film is what can be done to help people who are in pain or simply want to be able to mitigate some of their emotional pain, not necessarily always physical, but having the means to do it that's legal and safe. Thanks so much for the time you were able to spend with us.
Thank you. Bye.
Saul Tryon, one of the executive producers of Neurons to Nirvana. After a break, we'll look at a film with a simple message. We've run out of time for Point Counterpoint about a changing climate. The real question is how we cope. Next up, Breath of Life.
I was looking for a breath of life, a little touch of heavenly light, but all the choirs in my head said, oh. To get a dream of life again, a little vision of the sun in the air, but all the choirs in my head said,
on the next Radio Lab, we ask.
She takes a look at him and says,
a question.
Who are you?
Then he looks at his mother. He says, Doctor, who is this woman?
She was thinking this is some strange man who's sitting here in, you know, her husband's clothing.
This woman looks exactly like my mother, but she's an imposter.
An imposter?
She is an imposter.
Can you ever really know another person? Like, really know? That's on the next Radio Lab.
Saturday morning at 10.
A lot of crime fiction owes its roots to medieval England.
The works of Chaucer, for example, give us some of the best crime fiction in the Western tradition. Chaucer's Pardoner's Tale is about a triple homicide. The Prioress's Tale is about child murder.
I'm Sarah McConnell. Join me for With Good Reason, tonight at 6:30 on Hawaii Public Radio.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and this is a special edition of Town Square. Tonight, we're talking with some of the filmmakers whose work is screening at the Maui Film Festival. If you've just joined us, we're recorded tonight to bring you these conversations, so the phone lines aren't available. We may no longer be strangers to climate change and survival challenges facing humanity. Doing something about it, well, that's another issue, and it's one taken up by filmmaker Susan Kuchera. Filmed in Europe, Scandinavia, North America, and Hawaii, Breath of Life presents dozens of interviews with those studying what's happening and the people directly affected by it, and offers hope from way out in the Pacific. In watching the film, one of the clear messages seems to be, we all have a problem and we're not doing very much to solve it. And we all need a real kick in the pants. Some would say we've been having kicks in the pants for a while, but that we don't seem to be listening and that we don't tend to really want to take care of a problem until it's so undeniable that we have to. Many of the scientists you talk to really let us know that from their perspectives, we are at that undeniable point. So why aren't we listening?
Well, that's what we set out to explore in this film. What is it in our evolutionary biology and psychology that causes us to be this way, where we know there's a problem, we're cognitive, we're aware of it, sometimes it's right in our face if we happen to be in Hurricane Sandy, but still we don't do anything? And that's an interesting question. We almost have to overcome our evolutionary past in order to move forward.
Even with simple things that could be potentially life-threatening, when people go to the doctor and their physician says, you know, you really ought to lose weight, you need to eat a little bit better, please get some more exercise, and there's a lot of lip service, and then life slips right back into the same old patterns. What kind of disruption do you think we're going to have to experience to be able to deal with many of the questions that come through your film?
I think if we experience some sort of collapse, obviously we're going to have to deal with things then. We don't want things to come to that, but we practice cognitive dissonance in our everyday lives. We also think things really aren't going to happen to us. We practice confirmation bias, so even though we know there's a problem, every time we see a little piece of news that might tell us, well, technology is going to fix something, then we go on to that. We think, well, it's not going to be so bad. You know, something's going to come along. And so this film, you know, by looking at some of the stark facts that you saw, I hope people will realize that these things are real and we really aren't doing anything. Or if we are, we're sort of consuming another solution. We're not actually changing our fundamental way that we think.
But it may be foisted on us at any point. If we look at some of what we see in the film, it's already happening in that way, particularly when it comes to the issue of water. Obviously, in Hawaii, water is as big of a deal, if not more so, than any other place, because, you know, we're in an island, we can't bring it here from someplace else. But looking at some of those fields, not just in Texas, but the drought that California's been experiencing for quite a while now, and the projection may be that it's going to go on for a while longer, what that while looks like and the notion of time seems to also be an issue that we don't grapple with terribly much. There was some mention there in the film of a 100-year drought. And our most recent understanding of that might be, you know, what happened with the Dust Bowl.
Sure. One of the speakers or the fellows that I interviewed, he put it this way, we really do have sort of Stone Age appetites in an age of abundance. And we just keep going along because that's what made it successful in the past. One of the reasons I brought in the Hawaiian culture, of course, that whole notion that we're all in the same canoe, and we have reached the limits of everything. And so the Hawaiians obviously realized that a long time ago, and they were able to address that. They were able to create a culture that allowed them to be sustainable. And obviously we're going to have to do the same thing, but it's really difficult to fight against your own biology.
Or the fact that we live in an age where it's so easy to find people who will agree with you, literally at the touch of a button in a simple click.
Right. Right. And also, the way our culture is set up, the way the infrastructure is set up, everything just arrives magically at the store. We don't see how it gets there. We have no clue about all these things. It's just there. The strawberries are there, whether they're in season or not. So we're really detached from reality, and we're going to have to start addressing that issue.
Well, in some ways, we're forced to address it in Hawaii because we have to bring everything in, and it starts to hit our pocketbooks, wallets, pretty heavily when we're paying premium prices for some of that produce. We've talked a long time about what we want to do to decrease our carbon footprint. Paul Roberts was here a couple of years ago now, and we sat down and talked.
Oh, right. Yes, he's in the film.
As we look at all of these reasons to do it, it seems that we're not exactly at that tipping point of actually doing it, which seems to be the overarching question of the film of why, if we know all this stuff, are we not doing any of it? You also interviewed David Corton in the film, and one of his more recent books was The End of Empire. Is that what you're suggesting in this film, that maybe with all of the issues we're dealing with, we have to regard this as the end of empire?
Well, I think our problems are going to hit us in the face maybe sooner than we think. And one way of looking at it, if you have, in the 1940s or 50s, I think it took one unit of energy to produce 100 out. We take one unit of energy to produce 11 out. And pretty soon we're going to be down to one unit of energy in, only 5 out. And so climate change aside, we're going to have a problem, you know, having the amount of money that it would need to take to fix cities that have been affected by ocean rising. We're not going to be able to fix the ocean acidification. We're really not going to be able to turn things around. And this is at a time where we're going to have less and less money to fix these problems. So pretty soon they really will be in our faces. And then at that point, what do we do? Obviously, it's important for people to become just more conscious and aware of the fact that it's not their fault. They're fighting their own biology. They're fighting their evolutionary psychology. But maybe just to realize that they don't act. They don't really do anything. Or if they do something, they just think, well, if I switch from eating a Twinkie, maybe if I just go buy an organic Twinkie, that will make things okay.
Well, and that's a whole other issue of thought. Well, okay, we'll just make substitutions. But the bottom line should be, well, we like to eat. So how is it that we're going to be able to eat in this place and do it well, given the fact that we see so many changes outside? When Paul Roberts was here, when he published The End of Food, one of his big points was, you know, you've got to look at what you can do to increase how much Hawaii can produce. And we're thinking, well, yeah, we've been dealing with that question for a while. Are you seeing any real movement in that direction? There seems to be a lot of questions whether we're actually grappling with how well we use our arable land to provide food for us.
Right. Well, I lived in Washington State for a long time, and I was very involved in land use issues. And, of course, when you take a piece of farmland, and the best way to make money off of it is to rezone it. So people were always fighting there over farmland. I think that people here are a little more advanced. There is a lot of local food being grown, but it's more than that. It's where the water is coming from. Obviously, we have to get more local.
Get more local in what sense? I mean, we've had the locavore movement. We have some farms that are producing and putting it out right here, not just shipping things away. But we also have a very finite plot of land. Others who have been suggesting that we look at hydroponics and aquaponics and other ways of being able to use it more efficiently. And whereas we pay that a lot of attention in conversation, when it's time for some of the money, there are those who are suggesting to us that it's not really happening, and they're trying to make that sync up with the need, given some of the issues that you put out in the film.
Right. Well, it's not an easy thing to solve. And if you, since this is really about the human organism, and every human organism wants to be comfortable and healthy, but part of that now is making enough money to feel comfortable, healthy, maybe giving money to our kids. But if you own a piece of land, maybe you don't see how rezoning that into urban is going to help anyone but your offspring. So you don't really see how the actions that you take now will actually affect future generations. And so 108 billion people have walked the surface of the earth and perished. And we're 7 billion people right now. And so everything that we do right now is affecting future generations. And so how do you wrap your head around something that you do now that will affect people into the future, people that you may not know, may not even be related to? That's a really hard thing to think about.
Added to that disconnection is, in our case over in Hawaii, the physical location and our disconnect from other places and even from ourselves, island to island.
Sure. I that's why I wanted to look at the Hawaiian culture. Brian Fagan, I interviewed, he said that if there had been no contact, Hawaiians would still be living here, thriving. There would still probably be, you know, skirmishes and things like that between neighboring islands, but in effect they had figured out a way to be symbiotic with the land, and yet they were still able to be a complex civilization. And so now we are so complex. Without this sort of free energy that we have, we would see cascade and collapse come pretty quickly if we didn't have that energy input. And so it's kind of a conundrum. What do? You want to go solar, you want to do all these things, but our whole civilization is set up for input for almost free energy.
We hear from a lot of folks that if there hadn't been contact or if this hadn't happened or that hadn't happened, but your point seems to be, well, all that happened and here we are now. And the real question is, what are we going to do about it? For Hawaii, do you see our problems as more acute than any other place, or do you feel that somehow there is something that Hawaii can offer to the rest of the country, or perhaps the rest of the world, that isn't now being talked about as much as it should?
Well, I think what the Hawaiian culture and the cultural practitioners are trying to teach us is that we really have to have a different way of thinking. You know, you can act and do a few things, but unless you fundamentally change the way you think, that's not going to continue. You might a few little token, you know, acts, get solar, do a few things, but unless you really fundamentally change the way you think, we're really going to go nowhere. And people have to stop thinking of themselves as sort of immortal. We're not immortal. We're finite beings. Everything that we do now is going to affect everyone in the future. And maybe then we can start having a real discussion about what we should do. Each place in the world needs to start doing that.
Thinking about Hawaii specifically, obviously that's why you wanted to include Hawaii in the film. Is there something that you think that we should be talking about now and we still aren't?
Well, we live in this culture. We create it and we're created by it. And I think we have to start looking at different cultural memes. And I think the Hawaiian culture is a perfect meme that perhaps we have to start adopting. And that starts with a different way of thinking.
Susan, I want to thank you for making time for us.
Okay, thank you very much. Aloha.
Susan Kuchera produced, directed, and filmed Breath of Life.
You know, it's diverse programming, and one of the things I like is that the more I listened, the more I was able to find different things on public radio. You know, their Saturday lineup and their Sunday lineup are entirely different, but it's a great way to multitask with both information and diversion as a part of the experience. You have a lot on public radio that keeps you both informed and entertained.
Member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Radio with vision. Listen and see.
Next up, a film whose subject you probably don't know, even if his medical inventions or Segway personal transporter may already be in your life. Dean Kamen is a singular man. Childless by choice, he devotes his time to solving some of humanity's biggest problems. His 15-year quest to create a potable water distiller is documented by filmmaker Paul Lazarus in Slingshot. The film starts with the question of the man on the street asking, do you know who Dean Kamen is? And some of the bizarre answers that you got. Was that at all surprising to you?
No, to be honest, I had had that experience so often of people would say, what are you doing? And I'm working on a documentary with Dean Kamen, and they would look puzzled, and I would say, do you know who Dean Kamen is? And every one of them would say no. And then I'd say, well, are you aware of the Segway device? And everybody would say yes. And then about 50% of the people that I was talking to would say, I thought he died. And I realized that because of the confusion that had been created by a man named James Heseldine, who owned the Segway company, did indeed go off a cliff on a Segway and die. And somewhere in the media, confusion was huge that it was actually Dean Kamen had died. And I thought, gee, what a kind of interesting metaphor for how people just don't know who scientists are or inventors in the world. And the movie that's going to introduce the world, I think, Dean Kamen, wouldn't it be funny to start with people thinking he's dead? And so I sent out a young team to Venice Beach with the idea of asking four questions, and that's what it led to.
in a way, perhaps going into it, you wouldn't be as surprised given the fact that we're in a world where most people tend to know more about celebrities and sports stars than they do about, in many cases, their own families. But people who add to the wellness of life and to the well-being that many people share are often not as well-known as in this case. But then again, there's sort of that situation that's happened with science in the last couple of years, especially we've noticed that there are people who think that, you know, science somehow isn't as worthy as it once was, which I'm sure would not be happy news to Dean Kamen. In part, was that why you did this film?
It's certainly a piece of the story. I have had been very blessed to have spent a lot of time with Dean Kamen over the last three decades, and I've watched him make almost a solo effort at changing the momentum of what you're talking about, and particularly through his organization, FIRST Robotics, which is aimed at primarily at kids. He's really trying to change the culture where science is really respected and revered, and hopefully people think it's cool, which I think on some level that may be the most important thing to Dean, is that science not be thought of as a dull, meaningless activity, science including invention and all technology, but that it be thought of really for what it really is, which is changing the world every day for the better, usually, hopefully, and also a very, very cool life to live if you pursue it, and one that you might actually earn a living, unlike the millions of kids who are trying to be professional sports stars, you know, the 0.001% or whatever the real number is of people actually earn a living at sports. Yet we think sports are just the coolest thing on the planet, but we have this shortage of kids who are going into mechanical, electrical, biological engineering, and there are jobs in every one of those areas available.
Especially when you're talking to 9, 10, 11, 12th graders, that those years where cool is really the thing to be, giving them an avenue to see that it might also be a way to make a living and enjoy your life seems to be a completely different perspective on this celebritization of life that we often get. Getting attention for doing something good for humanity, though, isn't purely altruistic. I mean, there is a money factor into this, too, and how that's blended seems to also be at the heart of the film and looking at what it means to create compromise, especially when we're talking about the water project, which in many ways, water has become the new currency of diplomacy.
You know, the movie's primary focus is Dean's water purification technology, which he calls Slingshot. That's the name of the movie. And in terms of the compromises you discussed, I mean, we're facing a world where a large, large percentage of the world don't even have access to clean water. And it's going to take a huge collaborative effort between governments and innovators and companies and the public to address this ever-growing crisis. And you know, the movie, that's fundamentally what the movie is about, which is how do you take on something that's really gone for so long without anyone's attention and has reached unbelievable crisis proportion. There are so many, over a billion people on the planet that don't have access to clean water, and 50% of all illness on the planet is directly due to waterborne pathogens. When you reach figures like that, the whole world has to start compromising. And you know, we live in the lovely Western developed country of the United States where water is just simply taken for granted. We go to our taps, we turn it on, and we have clean running water at a quality level that's, you know, unheard of in most of the world. It's hard to get America to wake up to something that we have, but the truth of it is that we are already in peril, even in this country, with our water supply for all sorts of other reasons, and the movie talks about that too. We're just heading into a whole different planet of how we live our lives. People just have no clue. And I frankly was one of those very naive people about 8 years ago. I just didn't have any idea how serious the water supply of the world is threatened. And you know, we have it fantastic compared to most places I've been. I was fortunate to go to Ghana to watch trials of the Slingshot machine. And we went to villages that have never, ever seen running clean water in their entire history. And then suddenly the Slingshot machine appears and young kids are getting water for the first time in their school situations. And it's just a unbelievable moment.
It puts a lot of things in perspective about your own life and about the rest of the world, and as you say, how lucky we are. In Hawaii, water is a very big issue because although we're surrounded by it, it has many, many different takers. Hawaii very often gets forgotten in all of that. You'd be surprised how many times Hawaii isn't included in planning. And just out of curiosity, yeah. I'm wondering if we even get on your radar.
Hawaii is very much a part of the United States. Now, one of the reasons that I made the movie was, there were sort of three reasons I made the movie, but one of them was to help people's attitudes towards water in general. And I don't think you create change anywhere until you create a shift in the dialogue about a topic. And right now, I think very regrettably, there is no huge awareness about how troubled the world's water supply really is. I don't think after you've seen Slingshot, you can ever think about water the same way. And that's very important to me and everyone involved with this picture, that we just alter your perception about the whole issue of water. And then once perception's been altered, once there's some dialogue about how much things need to change, then you start to have awareness and ability to create some legislature that actually makes change. I would suspect that what's going to come down in Hawaii is the same as everywhere else. We're going to stop taking water for granted. We're going to start recycling water. We're going to start using gray water. There's an image in the movie where a beautiful golf course is being watered. And one of my biggest ambitions was by the time you'd watched 70 or 80 minutes of the movie, you would get a little queasy seeing that image, because you would think about the fact that that water being spread all over that golf course, which is, you know, a totally recreational activity, that's clean, potable water. That's the same water that could save a child's life somewhere else. And we just have to become aware of these things, and we have to start doing what Singapore is already doing, which is using the same water from our showers and our toilets and our sinks and our washers and dishwashers, and put it back into a municipal plant, have it cleaned, and have it come back to us. You know, that's what I mean by recycling water. Once you start doing that and you stop wasting huge amounts of water, then we can address all these issues. But those laws are going to be coming before, I suspect, Hawaii in a relatively short time. And the critical thing is that we're prepared for it, understand it, and we start to pass these laws.
That legislation is, as you say, already something that we're grappling with in the way that many other states are, but particularly here, because we are an island, we can't necessarily bring in water from any other places. You're right, though, seeing the golf course and all of the water that very often is trying to keep it green and lush and so compelling almost gives you a feeling of revulsion when you see it, both in the film and if you're passing someplace where it's being watered. In looking at water differently, you also ask us to look at how we regard partnerships with some other big companies, particularly in this case Coca-Cola, a little differently. And that for some people may be difficult until they see how deftly that has been accomplished.
Yeah, there's cliches on all sides of questions. And one of the cliches that I'm not very fond of is that everything to do with big business is bad. You know, it's as big a cliche as anything else. And the truth of it is that when companies who typically have a profit motive start to use that profit motive for good, they should be rewarded just like anybody who does good. And in the case of Coca-Cola, who you're talking about, they've signed on with Dean Kamen to help distribute this machine and this technology that frankly languished for a good 15 years. So you have to ask yourself the question, when someone does good, are they bad or are they good? And it's my opinion that good in the world should be rewarded and bad should not be. And, you know, the film is very clear and truthful about Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola hasn't always done good. They've done some pretty strange and crazy things with their, you know, profit motive.
Especially in India, where we heard about that several years ago.
Yeah, and India was a case in point where Coca-Cola made some, I think, very serious missteps. But that was 2004. It's 10 years later, and you have a new CEO of Coca-Cola named Muhtar Kent. And, you know, I think there are many motives why people get involved with helping people get access to clean water. Some of those motives are altruistic. They just want to help people. Some of the motives might be we want better PR. Some of the motives might be let's win a Nobel Peace Prize. I'm not sure I care what the motive is as long as people get clean water. And I think Dean Kamen goes on record as saying that as well. And when you find out the facts about water and just how many children in particular are dying each year because they don't have access, or how much time is being spent just acquiring water all over the world, you really want to see this technology succeed. And, you know, that's, I guess, the first and foremost ambition of the movie is to help get this incredible life-saving and health-giving technology out into the world.
And as that's happening, also show that there can be corporate redemption and there can be change that's brought about with big companies as well as small grassroots movements.
Yeah, and what's interesting about the Slingshot Challenge is that even the entry of Coca-Cola isn't enough. The forces that will help get this technology really out into the world where it can do some good require not only the innovation of this genius, Dean Kamen, not only the economic and distribution reach of Coca-Cola, but it also needs the NGOs, the non-government organizations on the ground, to help people understand the value of clean water, how to deal with it, sort of the educational and cultural demands. So it's a partnership and a set of compromises that spans the whole breadth of what's going on today. I mean, you need innovation, you need companies, you need governments, you need NGOs, you need the people themselves to help sustain the technology. All of those forces are going to have to come together to make Slingshot work. And that's kind of what the movie's about, is that if there's hope for our planet, and if there's hope for what we've already trashed in our planet, it's going to require everybody to come together. And on all sorts of ways and with all sorts of resources and passion, you know, or the documentary could have been very dire. I mean, I've seen, I'm sure you have too, I've seen endlessly dire, hopeless movies about the world's water crisis. There have been many. But we wanted to make something that was hopeful, inspirational, and showed that it requires commitment and it requires lots of different entities to come together.
And also an open mind and a questioning one to see that there may be possibilities that other attitudes may have simply relegated to the we're not going there place. Thanks so much for spending some time at our place with us. We appreciate it.
Oh, happy to do it, and I hope people will come see the movie in Maui.
Paul Lazarus, the director of Slingshot, a documentary focusing on inventor Dean Kamen. That's the show for tonight. Next week, we'll be back with you live. Join guest host Neil Milner when he sits down for a conversation with former governor Ben Cayetano. Thanks for joining us tonight. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and I'll see you soon. Aloha.